Just three short announcements before we start. Announcement number one, I'm going to set a good personal example. I'm going to silence my phone. So I would like to encourage others to follow suit. Announcement number two is there will be a minyan for Maariv about 5 minutes after the lecture. This time the minyan will take place downstairs. When you go into the lobby downstairs, there is a suite of classrooms downstairs, and Maariv will be in room C. Room C. It will be Mechitza Maariv, and there will be a Mechitza there. The last thing that I want to announce before Rabbi Landes takes over is that in our community education program next week, there is a Tiyul. There are still about 15 spots left on the Tiyul. The Tiyul will be led by tour guide Shuli Mishkin, and it's part of our series of modern Zionist thinkers. The tour will be going to Mazkeret Batya and looking at the farmers of the first Aliyah, and then it will move to visit the home of Chaim Weizmann in Rehovot. And anybody who would like to participate in the Tiyul, as I say, there are about 15 places left, can email me. My email is alex@pardes.org.il, alex@pardes.org.il. So people are welcome to participate, and I'll send them all the details. Okay, thank you very much. Oh, sorry, I should have said what date it was. Okay, it is next Thursday. Next Thursday, it's the 25th. Next Thursday, not tomorrow, but next Thursday.
Even with an elevator, we have a great crowd. Sid, you escaped it last week, but I'll make it really short. Thank you for your vision in putting this together. Thank you for your partnership. And thank you that you've involved three generations in cooking this up. And Cain Yerbu, this should only continue. And we're very happy that our lecturer, who you have a lot of good fans, want to learn from you, and therefore we'll start right now. It's Pardes, we start.
Okay. Erev Tov, it's wonderful to be back here at Pardes for our second session of Megillat Rut. Tonight we're going to be talking about kindness to the foreigner, Ruth the Moabite, meets Boaz in the field. So we're going to be focused naturally on the second parak of Megillat Rut. In the previous class, we discussed the way in which Naomi's personal predicament should be understood within a national context. That was the main idea in the last class. In other words, the predicament, the personal predicament of Naomi and the family of Elimelech is essentially a microcosm of the national situation. And today I want to discuss the manner in which Naomi's personal predicament is resolved in the Megillah, at least partially tonight, with an eye towards understanding how the dire national situation during the period of the judges that we described at great length in the last class may in fact be resolved. Now, the Megillah begins by presenting a tragic situation for Naomi and her family, right? That's the introduction to the Megillah. We have the death of her husband, the death of her two sons. In fact, if we look in Perek Aleph of Megillat Rut, at the end of this initial introduction in Pasuk Hey, we're told, Vayamutu gam shnehem, machlon v'chilyon, they also died, the two of them, her two sons. Vatisha'er ha'isha mishnei iladeha umeisha. The woman was left all by herself, without her husband, without her two sons. And as a result of the death of her family, she is left with two formidable concerns. She has two existential dangers that attend the death of her family. One of her concerns, one of her problems, is of a long-term nature. Naomi and the family of Elimelech have no children left. She has no real hope of producing an heir. She is left alone without any continuity. Her continuity is threatened. This is what she is going to tell her Moabite daughters-in-law in Perek Aleph, Psukim, Yud Aleph, and you'd bet, right? Verses 11 and 12 in chapter 1, she tries to dissuade her daughters-in-law from accompanying her. And she says to them, Ha'od li vanim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem l'anashim? Do I have any more sons in my innards that can be for you as husbands? Shovna v'notai lechna, return my daughters, go. Ki zakanti miyot le'ish. I am too old to be with a man. Ki amarti, even if I would say, Yesh li tikva, I have some hope, which of course she wouldn't say that because she does not have any hope. Gam hayiti halayla la'ish, v'gam yaladti banim. If by some miracle, tonight I would be with a man and I would birth children. Halahen tisaberna adasher yigdalu. Are you going to wait around until they grow up? Halahen teagena, right? This is milashon aguna. Are you going to be anchored, livilti hayot leish, not to be with a man, al binotai, no, my daughters. And so here we have a sense of Naomi's loss of hope, and she really does not have any hope here for any continuity. There seems to be very little hope that she doesn't at all assume that her Moabite daughters-in-law could possibly find a husband in Beit Lechem, and she has no more husbands to provide for them. And so Naomi's situation is that of no more continuity. She has no hope for children. The other problem that Naomi faces at the beginning of the Megillah is more of a short-term nature. Naomi has no sustenance. She has no means for economic survival. When she left Beit Lechem, when the family left Beit Lechem, the family left behind their nachala, they left behind their estate, their inheritance, and their fields. We don't know exactly what happened to these fields. In fact, in Perek Dalet, in chapter 4, in verse 3, when Boaz gets up and he speaks to the elders, he's going to talk about this field, but it's rather obscure what happened to it. He says, Chelkata sadeh asher la'achinu le'elimelech machar Naomi Hashava Miste Moav. That portion of field, it has been sold or it's being sold. It's not exactly clear what happened with this field, whether it was sold before the family left or if it was laying fallow for all these years, waiting for the family to return. In either case, it makes very little difference for Naomi because Naomi returns to Beit Lechem without means. Naomi's immediate existence is in jeopardy, right? Her ability to survive, her ability to obtain food tomorrow is in jeopardy. And so Naomi describes herself as empty, right? She says, Ani mle'a halachti v'rekam heshivani Hashem. I left full and I have returned empty. She left full, she left with children, she left with means, she returns without children, she returns without the means to survive. Naomi's bitterness in this initial chapter, in chapter 1, is palpable. Her hopelessness is overpowering. We've already seen some indications of that, but I'm going to mention a few more phrases in which she expresses her anger at God, the manner in which she feels utterly alone in her pain, and the way in which she feels that she is the direct victim of God's wrath. The following expressions that Naomi expresses really gives us a sense of her bitterness and her feeling that God has lashed out directly at her. She says, Mar li me'od mikem. She says, I am more bitter than you. She says this to her daughters-in-law. And she goes on and she says, Yatze'avi yad Hashem. The hand of God has gone out against me. She goes on and she says, Heimar shaddai li me'od. God has greatly embittered me. She says, Rekam heshivani Hashem. God has brought me back empty. These are all in one very short sequence of psukim. And then finally she says, Hashem anabi vishadai heirali. God, Anna is really a question what it means. Does it mean God tormented me or does it mean God testified against me? The latter is probably the correct reading. God testified against me and then he did great evil to me. And look at all the times that Naomi emphasizes me. God has lashed out against me. God has punished me. God has greatly embittered my life. This is a portrait of Naomi that we get in the first chapter of Megillat Rut. Naomi, and I think it comes as no surprise after this description, seems to share certain common features with another well-known biblical character, and that is, of course, Eov, right? Two people who begin their lives with everything and then lose it all only to rebuild once again. One salient linguistic parallel that I brought for you here in the source sheets, in source number one, is relates to this pasuk that I just cited, in which Eov says, "Chai el hesir mishpati vishadai heimar nafshi." Look at how he describes God using the same name of God, which is not the most common name of God, the name Shaddai, and also that God embittered my soul. It's virtually the same thing that Naomi says in Perek Aleph in verse 20, right, which I put for you here in the next, in the same source, Al tikrena li Naomi, karena li mara, don't call me Naomi, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter, ki heimar Shaddai li me'od, because Shaddai, God, has embittered me greatly. Moreover, like Eov, who it is well known that he expresses the wish that he had died at birth, right? Eov curses the day that he was born, and he expresses the wish that he had died in childbirth. Naomi herself, certainly in chapter one, doesn't seem to have much interest in survival. Her hopelessness, her bitterness are that strong. She seems to really have given up. She pushes away her daughters-in-law, preferring to be alone in her misery. She also pushes away the women of Beit Lechem. Not that the women of Beit Lechem are falling over themselves to help Naomi, but Naomi, in her preemptive speech to them, Naomi rejects her pleasant name. She rejects the possibility of any sort of pleasant future, any possibility for hope, any possibility for rejuvenation. Let's look at her speech in Perek Aleph in chapter 1, Psukim Kaf and Kaf Aleph, where Naomi says as follows, Vatomer Alehen. The women only said two words. They see her and they say, Hazot Naomi. Is this Naomi? Now the Gemara, I mentioned this last time, has a reading that suggests that those two words are spoken in a mocking tone. Hazot Naomi? Is that the Naomi that abandoned us in her time of satiation when we were all starving? Look at her now. But it's not at all clear that that's the tone. We actually don't hear the words. All that we hear, though, is the tone of Naomi. Listen to what she says. Al tikrena li Naomi, karena li mara, ki heimar Shaddai li ma'od. We read that pasuk already. Anim le'ah halachti, I left full. Virekam heshivani Adonai. And God returned me empty. Lama tikrena li Naomi. Why should you call me pleasant? V'Adonai anavi, v'Shaddai heirali. God has testified against me, and God has done evil to me. She doesn't ask the women for anything. She basically just asks to be left alone by her daughters-in-law, by the women of Beit Lechem. What we see in the very next verse is that it's harvest time, right? Everybody goes out to the harvest. In the last verse of chapter 1, Vatashov Naomi Viruta Moavia Chalata Ima Hashava Misnei Moav Vehema Bau Beit Lechem Bitchilat Kitzir Haseorim. They come back to Bethlehem at the time that everybody is harvesting the barley harvest. And yet, Naomi doesn't ask for anything, and nobody brings her anything. It is quite likely that Naomi and Ruth are going to starve. No one has brought food. It appears that no one will. There are two reasons not to bring food. One is because, of course, Naomi abandoned them, presumably with food, at a time that they were having a famine. And the other reason is who would bring food to a Moabite girl whose nation is renowned for their refusal to bring food to Am Yisrael when they were coming out of Mitzrayim? I'm referring to an explicit verse that I mentioned in the last class in Devarim in chapter 23, where we're told that Moabites and Ammonites are not allowed to marry into the congregation of Israel because al divar asher lo kidmu etchem belechem uvemayim bederech betzeitchem mitzrayim, because they didn't bring you food and water on your way out, on your journey out of Egypt. And so Naomi comes back to Beit Lechem. She has no crops. She has no harvest. She has maybe a land which is lying fallow, if it hasn't been sold already, but it certainly doesn't help her. She has no independent means of sustenance and no hope for immediate survival. In fact, when Ruth promises to Naomi that she is going to accompany her, come what may, in that great speech of loyalty in chapter 1, it's very striking that three times Ruth uses the word mavet, right? She says, ba'asher tamuti amut, where you die, I will die, v'sham akaver, and there I will be buried. And then she goes on and she takes an oath, ko yasa Hashem li v'cho yosif, ki hamavet yafrid, b'ni uveinech. Only death will part us. I think that Ruth, in her speech, seems to understand that returning with Naomi to Beit Lechem means that imminent death is a real option. There is a real threat of survival that is hovering over Naomi and by extension also over Ruth when they return back to Beit Lechem. So returning to these two aspects of Naomi's misfortune, we spoke about food or about the harvest on the one hand and children on the other hand. I want to suggest that these are flip sides of the same coin. The quest for harvest, the quest for children, they're both a quest for zera, right? They're both a quest for a seed, for growth, for continuity, for survival, for the very bare essence of existence. That's what Naomi does not have. There is a parallel here that is being created between obtaining Adam and obtaining Adama, right? Man and earth, seeds of food and seeds of children. One could call it short-term survival and long-term survival, perhaps physical survival and metaphysical survival. However we understand it, Naomi's situation is dire. It is very, very precarious. And yet, chapters 2 and 3 are going to turn around the entire picture. And it is, of course, going to be Ruth who is going to bring about, she's going to facilitate the turning around of the situation, changing the trajectory of the story. Chapter 2, and this is what we're going to talk about today, is about the solution of the problem of food. That's what chapter 2 is about. In the very beginning of chapter 2, Ruth turns to Naomi and says, Elecha na sadev ala katav ha-shibolim achar asherem tachin beinav. I'm going out and I'm going to find us food. She volunteers to go and find a solution for food. Chapter 3 is about obtaining a promise of marriage, stability, and the attendant expectation of children that will also emerge from this union. If in the first chapter, Naomi has neither hope for food nor for children, by the fourth chapter, she has both children and food. Not only does she have food, but she has the hope that she will always have food because this child seems to have received the land of Elimelech, the land which is going to sustain Naomi in her old age. Look for a moment at the very end of Megillat Rut in Perek Dalid, Psukim Yud Dalid, and Tetvav. Here we have immediately following the birth of the child, immediately after Vateled Ben, in verse 14 in chapter 4, the women, these same women, right, these same women who stood watching Naomi's bitterness and hopelessness in the beginning, they return at the end, Vatomarna Hanashim El Naomi. And these women say to Naomi, Baruch Adonai Asher Lo Hishpit Lach Goel Hayom. Blessed is God who has not withheld from you a redeemer on this day, Vikareshmo Bisrael, his name shall be called in Israel. V'hayalach l'meshiv nefesh u'lechalkel et sevateich. He will be for you a restorer of life, and he will provide for you in your old age. He will sustain you. So we have here both the child who is born and the promise that this will also resolve the problem of food. Now, how actually this occurs, I've already noted that it's Ruth that basically brings about this turnaround in Megillat Ruth. Megillat Ruth is really very structurally harmonious book. I mean, we have Perek Aleph, which is the problem, and Perek Dalet, which is the resolution of the problem. The problem has been resolved. And Bet and Gimel, chapters 2 and 3, seem to be the means that we get from Perek Aleph, from the tragic beginning, to Perek Dalet, which is the triumphant resolution of the situation. But chapters 2 and 3, and here I want to return to a point that I made in the last class, and that is that Rut is really the perfect short story. It is a literary masterpiece, and we're going to see it over and over and over in our shiurim. Here I want to draw your attention to what I brought you here in source number 2, which I called Structural Symmetry in the Book of Ruth. Now, this is only a partial indication of the structural symmetry in the Book of Ruth, but here I want to draw your attention to a remarkable structural feature in which chapter 2 and chapter 3 are really just parallel to one to the other. They mirror each other. If you look at chapter 2 consists of 3 scenes, okay? It begins with Ruth and Naomi. They're having a conversation. Ruth informs Naomi of her intention to go and bring back food. It's all about food. In the second scene, which is the lengthy scene in the chapter, Ruth and Boaz meet in the field. Boaz provides Ruth with food in the short term. He gives her lunch for today. And in the long term, he gives her a promise that she can continue to pick, to glean in his field for the duration of the harvest. Now, he explains that he does this because of her exemplary behavior. Right? He says, "Huged hu gadli et asher asit et chamotech." It has surely been told to me that which you did with your mother-in-law. And it seems to be that this is why he offers her the food. Now look at the third scene. In our third scene, Ruth returns to Naomi in Beit Lechem, where she shares her success with her mother-in-law. She tells Naomi of what has transpired. Vatageid lachamota et asher asta imo. She informs her of Boaz's promise. Look at the words. Ki amar elai im ha-ne'arim asher li tidbekin ad im kilu et kol ha-katzer asher li. He said to me, you can continue to glean, you can continue to cleave to the young men in the field until the harvest season is over. And of course, she also gives Naomi the food. Not only does she give her the promise of food in the long term, she also gives her that which she had saved from lunch that day. Vatiten la et asher otira misova. She gives her that which was left over. The next chapter contains 3 identical scenes, but in this case, we're no longer talking about food. Here, we are talking about obtaining marriage or obtaining children. We begin in the first part of chapter 3. Ruth and Naomi have a conversation. In this case, one striking difference, and I think you only see it once you're looking at the 2 chapters parallel one to the other. One striking difference is, of course, that Ruth does not initiate, right? It's Naomi that initiates. If in chapter 2, Ruth says, let me go and pick food for us, in chapter 3, she doesn't say, let me go and seduce Boaz in the field, right? That is Naomi's initiative. And she, of course, advises Ruth that she intends to seek for her repose, manoach, presumably referring to marriage. However, it is also possible that this scene itself, which is modeled after the Tamar and Yehuda scene and feels and seems like a seduction scene, we're going to talk about it next week, will lead to Ruth's pregnancy, will lead to her obtaining seed. Of course, the second scene of this chapter, we once again have the lengthiest scene in the chapter where Ruth and Boaz meet at the threshing floor. Boaz gives a promise to Ruth that he is going to obtain for her By tomorrow, he's going to obtain for her marriage. And once again, Boaz recalls Ruth's exemplary past behavior. He says to her, "Heitavt chasteicha acharon min harishon, livilti lechet acharei habachurim im dal v'im ashir." Your second kindness has been even greater than your first, that you came to find me, and I am an elderly man and not a young man. But of course, she also refers to her first kindness. He doesn't say what the first kindness is. Presumably, it's what he spoke about in chapter 2, which precipitated his decision to give her food. Now, why is he going to give her marriage? Because she is well known as being a person with exemplary moral behavior and kindness and generosity. Now, in this third scene in chapter 3, look at how linguistically it is parallel to the third scene in chapter 2. Ruth returns to Naomi once again, where she shares her success with her. She tells her, look at the words, "Vatagid la et kol asher asa la ha'ish." Ruth then informs her of Boaz's promise, "Ki amar elai al tavoy rekam el chamotech." Note there how the word rekam, right? It reminds us of Naomi's initial words. Naomi said, "I am empty." And now in this scene, she is no longer empty. And then, of course, Ruth gives Naomi, or she tells her about these 6 barleys which Boaz gave her, which are presumably a symbol of the children that he is going to give her. Okay, that's the way all of the Mefarshim and the Gemara and the Targum understands these 6 barleys, which of course are a very inadequate food supply. If they are meant to be a food supply, all of the different exegetes of the text understand the 6 barleys as some sort of symbol of the children that will come from Ruth. This is a very harmonious description. It suggests to us that these 2 parallel chapters want to indicate to us that there are 2 parallel problems. This is the way that I started out the shiur. We have 2 parallel problems. The problem of food it finds resolution in chapter 2, and the problem of marriage and continuity finds resolution in chapter 3. Moreover, if you look at this structure carefully, you see that the structure reveals a flow chart in which Boaz provides for Ruth and Ruth provides for Naomi. Now, as an aside, and I'm not going to talk about this too much, but I do want to mention as an aside that Boaz and Naomi never meet in the story, which is a very interesting point, right? Naomi and Boaz actually never meet. Not only that, but Boaz never gives anything directly to Naomi, right? Ruth is the mediator between Boaz and Naomi. Actually, Boaz never even refers to Naomi directly until chapter 4, when he's dealing with the official ceremony of what to do with her field in an attempt to try to marry Ruth, right? This is a very, interesting observation. I think it's important because it suggests, and this is another point that we're always going to keep our eye on, the monarchy that emerges from this story. And I think that here, positioning Ruth as a mediator between Boaz and Naomi, where presumably, there's a certain amount of tension. Don't forget, Naomi left Beit Lechem during the time of famine. It is certainly possible that, like the women of Beit Lechem, who are not inclined to bring food to Naomi, Boaz is also in that situation. And Ruth here functions as a mediator. She's the vessel that brings food, that brings children to Naomi. She is a reconciler, a figure who brings together perhaps people who are at odds one with the other. This is what the monarchy is about, right? The monarchy is about healing the rifts in the nation. In this sense, and this is really just a side point, I think that Ruth in this sense is really the ima shel malchut. She is the progenitor of kingship in that she can bring about reconciliation between perhaps 2 parties who seem to have tension or not a good relationship. So in our chapters, returning to the structure of our chapters, Boaz is the source of the food and of the children. Ruth is the vessel through which the source arrive at Naomi, who is the recipient. Now, this is all very illuminating in light of what we said last week, because I mentioned last week that Naomi represents the nation, right? That Naomi, her family, her problem, her predicament represents the nation. So if we understand it in this way, Boaz is providing through Ruth the resolution for the nation at this time. And yet we know who the actual source of food and children is, right? It certainly is not Boaz, and it's no human at all. In fact, an adequate food supply and fertility are both matters that are generally assumed, or that are always assumed, to be under exclusive divine control. And this is the well-known Gemara. I brought it for you here in source number 3, the well-known Gemara in Ta'anit. Again, I said generally assumed because it seems that Eliyahu is a figure which seems to presume that he has some measure of control over the reins and perhaps also over the life of this child. But here we have a Gemara which is talking about this that context, which says as follows: Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shlosha Maftechot Biado Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shelo Nimtzeru Biad Shaliach. There are three keys that are in the hand of God and have not been given over to a messenger. The Eluhen, Maftech Shel Gshamim, the key of rain, Maftech Shel Chaya, the key of childbirth, Umaftech Shel Tchiyat HaMeitim, and the key of reviving the dead. Now, if we go back to our story, what I want to suggest is that while it appears, at least from the chart that I've brought for you here, that Boaz is the primary catalyst for resolving the predicaments of Ruth and Naomi, if we look at the narrative a little bit closer, it offers a different picture. Megillat Ruth actually presents God as the original stimulus, as the prime catalyst for the resolution of these two major problems posed in the narrative. Where do we see this? God is very present in the book of Ruth. All the time we haven't mentioned the name of God. This is an important question in general, because in some books in Tanakh, God is more or less present. And we always want to pay attention to in what way God is present in the book. And so I'll mention that in Megillat Ruth, God is very present because the characters are very interested in God. There's a tremendous amount of mention of God. Baruch Hashem, Brucha At La Hashem, Yitein Hashem Lachem U'Mitza'en Menucha, Hashem Imachem, Yivarech Hashem. Everyone's mentioning God. But God's direct involvement in the actual events of Megillat Ruth occurs only twice. Only twice. Once at the very beginning of the book, and once at the very end of the book. In what ways does God intervene directly in the events of Megillat Ruth? Well, in our first occurrence, in chapter 1, verse 6, what we see is, V'takom hi v'chalotea v'tashav mistei Moav, ki shama'a bistei Moav, ki fakad Adonai et amo latet lahem lachem. God remembered his people to give them bread. The first way in which God intervenes is to provide food. And later in the Megillah, in the second and only other mention of God's direct intervention in the events of the story, we have a unique to Megillat Ruth, biblical description of a woman becoming pregnant. Generally, all of the barren women who become pregnant were told, Vatahar Vateled Ben. Usually there's a description of God remembered her and she became pregnant and she conceived and had a child. Look at Perek Dalid, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Here we have a very unique description where we're told, Vayikach Boaz et Rut Vatilo Leisha Vayavoyla, Vayiten Adonai La Herayon Vateled Ben. God gave her conception, and she gave birth to a child. God is responsible for food, and God is responsible for childbirth in this story. And so while it appears that Boaz is the catalyst, he's at the top of the flow chart, what we actually see when we look at the Megillah is that God is the reason for the resolution of the problems of the family of Elimelech. And in fact, the flow chart begins with God. God gives to humans, Boaz picks up the gauntlet, and he gives to Ruth then gives to Naomi. And once again, I want to come back to the monarchy, right? In a sense, I think this prepares us for the model of kingship that we are trying to build. The king is meant to be the human vessel of God. He is the one through whom God bestows his divine blessings on the world. He has to always remember what is his source, and he has to take responsibility for transferring to the world God's blessings. Now, in summary, what I've said until now is that there are two problems in the book of Ruth. One is food, the other is children, and we see the flow chart is identical in providing the resolution for these two problems. In our next class, I want to talk about Parak Gimel, and I want to talk about the murkier scenario in which the goal of obtaining continuity is achieved. Tonight, I want to talk about food, and I want to talk about Parak Bet and the problem of Naomi in obtaining food. And we know that the problem is compounded by the fact that not only doesn't she have food, but she's not likely to get food, both because of her personal actions in the past and because she's accompanied by this Moabite woman. So that's two strikes against her. And of course, because as I said in the previous class, this book, it takes place during the time of the judges. And the time of the judges is not a time when people give food, right? We see it with the story of Gideon, when Gideon asks the people of Sukkot and Penuel in chapter 8 of the book of Judges for food, and they refuse to give him food. And of course, we see it in the horrific story of the concubine, which I spent some length describing in our last class. The assumption in that story is that no one is going to give lodgings to strangers, to people who are on a journey, because nobody wants to give food. Now, I suggested in the last class that in the book of Judges, the nation of Israel has become like Moab, which of course is Sodom and Gomorrah. And that is the reason that they don't provide food. They have lost all semblance of social cohesiveness. That's a little summary of the last class for those people who missed it or don't remember. But we actually see this in our story as well, in the book of Ruth as well. The women don't bring food to Naomi, even though it is their harvest time, and we have been told that God has replenished their food supply. Fakad Hashem et amo latet lahem lachem. They have plenty of food, and yet they don't bring it to Naomi. The Midrash about Elimelech leaving his family, leaving his people because he and his family have food, is also a description of this period of the judges. But I want to show you also in Ruth Perek Bet what happens when Ruth actually arrives at the field of Boaz. Look in Ruth Perek Bet, Pasuk Gimel. Ruth goes to find a field where she can pick food. Vatelech vatavo. ותלקט בשדה אחרי הקוצרים. ויקר מקרה חלקת השדה לבועז אשר משפחת אלימלך. It's a little bit of a strange syntax here. And she went and she came and she picked in the field after the reapers, and a coincidence happened. It was the field of Boaz, who was from Mishpachat Elimelech, who's from the family of Elimelech. Vinei Boaz ba mi Beit Lechem. Boaz is coming from Beit Lechem. Vayomer lekutzrim, Adonai imachem. God is with you. Vayomru lo yivarechecha Adonai. God shall bless you. Vayomer Boaz linaaro hanitzav ala kutzrim. Lemi hanaara hazot. And Boaz immediately notices her. Now this, of course, causes the Gemara to ask the question. Is Boaz just asking about strange girls? Why is he asking about her? And the Gemara goes on to describe Ruth's exemplary behavior, which drew his attention. The exegetes go in different directions in understanding what motivates the question. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but for the present, I want you to see what the answer of the foreman is. Pasuk Vav, Vayan Hanar Hanitzav ala Kotsrim. The boy who is appointed over the reapers says as follows, Vayomar, Nara Moaviyahi, she's a Moabite girl. Hashava im Naomi miste Moav, who just came back with Naomi from Ste Moav. It's sounding a little derogatory. Vatomer, now he cites her words, he quotes her. Vatomer, and she said, Alakatana vasafti vaomarim, acharea kotsrim. I'm going to go out and I want to gather those bundles after the reapers. Vatavo, and she came.
ותעמוד מאז הבוקר ועד עתה. זה שבטה הבית מעט. And she came and she's been standing there since the morning. I want to draw your attention to what I think is the key word in this description, and that is vatamod. She's standing. What do you mean she's standing? Why is she standing? Isn't she picking? The classic way to understand the scenario in accordance with the Gemara and Shabbos is that she's all the way out there in the fields, right? She's picking, and Boaz looks out in the fields and he sees her, and she's picking modestly with wisdom. She picks only two sheaves and not three sheaves because she knows the halacha, right? And he says, oh, who is that girl out there who's doing those deeds? But it doesn't really cohere with the description of vatamod. I want to offer a different understanding of this scenario, and that is that Ruth arrives at the field and she says to the foreman, I'd like to pick. And he says, oh no, you don't. So I'm not going to kick you out of the field because this is Boaz's field and I don't really have the right to kick you out of the field, but you can wait here until Boaz comes along, if he comes along today. Of course, he's a wealthy landowner. He doesn't necessarily come to the fields every day. And if he wants, he can grant you permission. But of course, she's both a Moabite and Naomi's companion. And these are two good reasons that the Na'ar, who never gets a name in the story, actually seems to prevent her from picking. Now, this explains many, many things in the story. First of all, notice that Boaz doesn't answer the Na'ar. Boaz seems to be profoundly disturbed or annoyed by the Na'ar. He immediately turns to Ruth. First of all, it gives us a different understanding of why Boaz notices her, right? Because she's standing on the side not doing anything. Everybody's a hustle, a bustle of activity in the field, and Ruth is just standing. Vata'amod me'az ha'boker ve'ad'ata. But it also really explains Boaz's words. Because look at Boaz, look at what Boaz is going to say in Pasuk Chet. When he turns directly to Ruth, Vayomer Boaz al Ruth, Halo shamat biti, al tilchi lilkot besadeh acher, v'gam lo tavori mizeh. Don't leave. Why is he telling her don't leave? Unless she has one foot out, right? If she's out there in the fields, why is he telling her, he doesn't even tell her twice, he's going to tell her three times, don't leave, don't pass by us. V'chotid bakin im narotai. You should cleave to my young women. Einayich basadeh, asher yiktsarun. You see there, you see that field over there? That's where you should pick, right? He seems to be directing her to go and harvest with the other reapers. That's why he points to the field. That's why he notices her. Seems likely, given the scenario here, that Ruth has not been given permission to pick in the field. She's been waiting at the side for some time now, perhaps nervously contemplating the idea of returning to Naomi without food, or perhaps even trying her luck in another field, when just then Boaz arrives in the field. And look how the text presents Boaz's arrival in the field in Pasuk Dal. Vihine! Boaz ba mi beit lechem. Vihine implies a fortuitous circumstance, right? And behold, Boaz has arrived to save you from certain starvation. I want to suggest something else, and that is based on the Pasuk and Pasuk Gimel, where we have this sequence of verbs which describes her sojourn in the fields, vatelech, vatavo, vatilakate. I want to suggest, Rashi notes this rapid sequence of verbs, and he has one explanation for it. I want to pick up on the rather unusual syntax and suggest perhaps that what we're being told is that Ruth goes from field to field to field. And in every field she experiences, there's a certain sense of continuous, repetitive action here. Vatelech vatavo, vatelech vatavo vatelakate, vatelech vatavo vatelakate. She went, she came, she picked, she was kicked out. She went, she came, she picked, and she was ejected from the field. If, in fact, this is a scenario, we don't know for certain, right? This is certainly a speculative reading. Each time that Ruth enters a field, she is unceremoniously expelled from the field because, again, as I said before, she has two strikes against her. There are two good reasons not to give Ruth permission to pick in the field. The fortunate coincidence, which is alluded to twice, vayiker mikreha, a coincidence happened, and vihine Boaz babi meit lechem, the fortunate coincidence is that she happens upon Boaz's field. Why this is so fortunate, we're going to see in a moment, but one thing that I think we immediately have to pay attention to is that Boaz, everyone knows that Boaz is concerned with the religious obligations that are occurring in his field. In fact, when Boaz comes to the field, before he even goes to talk to the foreman, and we do have to ask ourselves, why is a wealthy landowner coming at the heat of the day in the middle of harvest season to the field? Well, presumably the answer is he wants to check on the state of his crops, but he actually never asks anybody about that, never. Not even once. His first thing that he does is he turns to the reapers and he says to them, Hashem Imachem. And that is the first word out of Boaz's mouth, is Shem Hashem. Now, generally, we regard this as an exchange of greeting, right? Hashem Imachem, which is basically hello. Yivrech Hashem, which is hello back, right? That's the way it's done, certainly, in Bnei Akiva and also in certain shuls, right? Certain shuls, when they call people up to the Torah, right? The person, before he makes the brachot, he says Hashem Imachem, and then the whole congregation responds, Yivrech Hashem. And so it's some sort of greeting, and yet there's another possible reading of this as well. It could actually be a conversation. There's before Boaz goes to talk to his foreman, he turns to the reapers themselves, who are actually responsible for the keeping of the mitzvot, and he asks them a question. Hashem imachem? Is God with you? Are you doing it properly? Are you leaving behind those sheaves that you've dropped? Are you keeping the mitzvot of leket and shikha and peah properly? And look at their response. Yivarechecha Hashem. Don't worry. God will bless you. And of course, we have a pasuk in Devarim Perikavdal, which I didn't bring for you, pasuk Yotet, where we're told, if you keep the mitzvot of the field, leman yivarechecha Hashem elokecha b'chol maaseh yadecha, God will surely bless you. And so this seems to be an exchange which indicates to us that Boaz is a man that is concerned with keeping his religious obligations. He comes to the field to check on what's going on with the impoverished people who are picking in his field. This may be the reason why once she gets to Boaz's field, she may not have been warmly embraced by the foreman, but at least she is not summarily expelled by the foreman from this field. And so, in the middle of this period, this dark period of the judges, when nobody is giving food, the book of Ruth has two people who give food. And both of these people, we do not expect that they will give food. And so they give food against the odds and in contrast to our expectations. The first one is, of course, Ruth. Right? Ruth, even though she comes from Moab, her first act is to search for food for Naomi. She volunteers to go and reap and harvest in the field like a pauper. She saves her leftovers. She comes home and she provides food to Naomi. Ruth abandons the norm, the norms of Moab. Her chesed, her giving of food, is a cornerstone in the story. Everything that she receives, she perceives to be for Naomi and not for herself. And this is especially true in regard to food. But I'm even more surprised by Boaz. And it's him that I want to concentrate on tonight. And Boaz is just one of the people in Beit Lechem. Despite the fact that his environment is an environment in which people do not give food, Boaz serves as a model of food giving. And in this way, he becomes the progenitor of kings. He becomes a Judean leader who can restore social cohesiveness to the people. But throughout the story, he's giving food, and I want to understand where that comes from. He gives food. Not only does he gives food to Ruth, the Moabite, the foreigner who has happened upon his field. He tells her three times. He basically begs her to stay in his field. He then tells her that if she gets thirsty, she can drink from the water that the boys have drawn. She shouldn't trouble herself by drawing the water from the well. And in an unanticipated display of personal compassion, in Pasuk Yudalid, Boaz himself hands Ruth food. He basically makes her lunch. Right now, he's not obligated to provide his reapers with lunch. Certainly not the people who come to the field because they are poor and he has an obligation to allow them to pick in the field. He certainly has no obligation to provide them with lunch. Look at what happens in Pasuk Yudalid. Vayomer la Boaz le'et ha'ochel. At the time that everybody went to sit down, Boaz is paying attention. Ruth has no food. She didn't bring lunch. Presumably, there's no food to bring lunch. And he says to her, Goshi halom, come near, ve'achalt min alechem, and you can eat from the bread, ve'tavalt pitech b'chometz, you can dip your bread in the vinegar, v'teshev mitzad ha'kotzrim, v'yitzbot la'kali, and he personally hands her roasted grain, v'tocha v'tispa v'totar, right? He personally gives her food. He offers her protection in the field, and then he instructs his reapers. Look in the next two psukim in verse 15 and 16. Vatakum lelaket vayitzav boaz et na'arav lemor gam bein ha'omarim tilaket velo tachlimuha. Let her pick among the bundles. Do not shame her. Vegam shol tasholu laminat zvatim va'azavtem. Draw out some sheaves from your bundles and leave them for her. Okay, so he not only does he give her a promise that she can be in the field, not only does he give her water that she can drink in the field, not only does he provide her with lunch, he also tells his reapers surreptitiously to drop her some extra food. Of course, she's gotten, according to my reading, she's gotten a late start in the day, and she wants to go back at least with an eifah of se'orim, with an amount that is going to be sufficient for herself and Naomi. I want to really focus our attention on Boaz and the manner in which he becomes the catalyst for reversing the trajectory of the book and, of course, of the era of Judges as well. The extraordinary thing in my mind is not what Boaz does. It's not merely the fact that he gives Ruth the Moabite food. It is how he does it and why he does it that makes Boaz different from everyone else in Beit Lechem. I mentioned, I think, in the last class that a primary reason for the lack of generosity, for the fact that people don't give food, is a general sense of alienation that prevails during the period of the judges. Society is fracturing, and during the period of the judges, society suffers from a loss of identity, a loss of names, and an inability to see the other. People are fundamentally alienated from one another without the ability to recognize a person, to see someone with a name, someone with an identity. One cannot see their needs. We have just put last week Yom HaShoah behind us. And I think that that's perhaps the most terrible and poignant example that we know of taking people and taking away their names, and then you no longer regard them as people. They're just numbers. And if they're just numbers, then they don't have the needs of people. And that's what happens during the period of Shoftim. No one gives food to the other because they do not see the other. They do not see the other's needs. They do not regard the other as a person. In fact, because the nation is fracturing socially, everyone is regarded as a foreigner. Everyone is regarded as a stranger. Everyone who is not me is the other. And therefore, I have no responsibility towards them. I have no obligation towards them. This is, in fact, of course, the way that Sodom functioned. Remember when Lot takes in the guests and the people of Sodom turn to him and say, Ha'ata ba, ha'chad ba lagur va'ishpot shfot? One person comes here to live, and he thinks he can judge us. He thinks that he can give us a sense of moral responsibility. He's just a stranger here. He's just an individual. The compartmentalization of society results in a society in which everyone regards everyone else as the other, as a foreigner. And this, of course, I think is symbolized and represented by the way people treat Ruth. Ruth the Moabite is indeed a foreigner. But at the time of the judges, everybody is a foreigner to each other. Everybody looks at everybody else and says, well, you're not from my tribe, or you're not from my immediate family, or you're not me. So why should I assume responsibility for you? Why should I regard you as a person who deserves my assistance? And Boaz, of course, is different. Boaz gives food to the foreigner, to a stranger. He regards Ruth as a person with an identity, someone who is a subject and not just an object, and deserves to be treated as such. And that's why, that's where it comes from, his ability to turn to her and say, don't go. If you get thirsty, you should drink from my water. And halot tziviti et ha'ne'arim levilti nogeich. I have told the boys not to touch you. Right here, again, we have a sense of how people objectify the other, regard the other as an object. Not only that, but Boaz sees Ruth. He doesn't see a Moabite. He doesn't see a number. He doesn't see someone devoid of a name. He sees Ruth. And look at what he says to her. He sees her deeds in Pasuk Yud Aleph and Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayan Boaz vayomer la, hu ged hu gadli kol asher asit et chamotech. It has surely been told to me everything that you did with your mother-in-law. Acharei mot ishech, v'tazvi avich v'imech v'eretz moladech v'telchei al am asher lo yadat mol shalshom. He now explains, he tells her all the things that he knows about her. He sees her as a person. He sees her deeds. He doesn't just see an alien. He doesn't just see a Moabite. He regards her as a subject, and Ruth is amazed. Look at what Ruth says in Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud, in verse 10. Look at what she says. After he first treats her as a person, and he first tells her, you can eat and you can drink, and I'm not going to let anybody harass you. Vatipol al paneha, she falls on her face. Vatishtachu arza, and she prostrates herself on the ground. Vatomeri love, and she says, Madua matzati chein beinecha lehakireni, vanochi nochria. This is the key. Why did you recognize me? I am but a stranger. Now, I think this is really the key, right? Because what she's saying is it's impossible. I'm amazed that someone has actually looked at me, that someone has actually recognized me for me, and I am but a stranger. Now, Naomi uses the same word when she expresses her astonishment at the way that Boaz treated Ruth that day. Look ahead in Pasuk Yud Tet, in the same parak, right, in verse 19. After Naomi sees what Ruth has brought back, Vatomer la Naomi, Eifo likatet hayom, ve'ana asit, yihi makirech baruch. Look at that word, to recognize. Let the one who recognized you be blessed. In fact, what I think we have here is a situation in which the right to be recognized is not presumed. It cannot be taken for granted. Naomi immediately understands it's not just that somebody gave you food. It's that somebody saw you. They saw you as a person. They saw you as a subject. They saw you as someone with needs. Now, this shoresh, this root, nakar, right, or lahakir, right, it appears one more time in Megillat Rut in chapter 3. And I want to show you this appearance in chapter 3. After Ruth spends the night innocently on the threshing floor where she slept under Boaz's protective watch, she gets up early in the morning. Look at what it says. I'm in chapter 3, verse 14. Vashtishkav margilotav ad haboker. She sleeps at his feet until the morning. Vatakom biterem yakir ish et re'ehu. She got up before a man recognized the other. Now, literally, of course, this refers to the time of day that she leaves the field, when it's still dark and there are shadows and one can't recognize other people. But I think that there's a metaphoric meaning to this verse. Ruth leaves the field during an historical era in which people are fundamentally alienated one from the other. And she brings about a society which brings about recognition once again. She gets up b'terem yakir ish et re'ehu at a time when people don't recognize their friend. There are several other interesting expressions of this. I'll mention them for lack of time. I'll just mention them as an aside, and you can look at them on your own time. One is that this also finds expression in the fourth chapter of the book of Echa, of the book of Lamentations, where in describing the social unraveling as a result of the famine in the city, what we're told is lo nikru bachutzot. Right? People are not recognized in the street. Now, that's a description of the ravages of famine. That's a description of starvation. But I think it's also a metaphoric description. People stopped recognizing each other. Famine led to a situation where mothers ate their children. People stopped seeing the other as a person. And perhaps in the paradigmatic story of social fracture and enmity between brothers, and that is, of course, the story of Yosef and his brothers, the word lahakir, to recognize the other, is a very prominent word. If you recall, after Yosef is sold by his brothers, the brothers try to divest themselves of responsibility for Yosef by presenting Yosef's coat to the father, to Yaakov, saying, Hakerna, you recognize. This is your responsibility, not our responsibility. And of course, as part of the attempt to resolve the problem of having sold Yosef into slavery, Tamar forces Yehuda to recognize his responsibility by using the words Hakerna. Okay, there's all sorts of expressions of this throughout the Yosef story. Of course, when Yosef recognizes his brothers, the Haim Lo Hikiruhu, right? He recognizes them in chapter 42. They don't recognize him. I'm not going to go into this too deeply, but I think that it suggests that the idea is that the minute that brothers no longer recognize brothers to the extent that they also recognize their responsibility for them, they see in them that they are people, that they are objects with needs, that's when civil war ensues. That's when society begins to fall apart. And Boaz, of course, gives Ruth food, not simply because he is a generous person, but because he sees her as a person. He sees her needs. He sees her personal righteousness. And note that Boaz is also concerned, not just with giving Ruth food, but one of the things that we see over and over is that Boaz is concerned with Ruth's dignity. He's concerned with her ability to preserve her sense of self and her pride. Of course, he tells the reapers, lo tachlimuha velo tigaruba, don't embarrass her, don't rebuke her. And one of the ways that we see, that we can discern Boaz's ability to see Ruth is if we pay careful attention to the use of names in this chapter. In the entire chapter, Ruth is referred to by her name four times. At the beginning of the chapter, when she's described in Beit Lechem, Vatelech, Vatavo, Vatilaket, we have the sense that she's sort of gliding anonymously through the fields of Beit Lechem, ignored, unnamed, unrecognized. At best, she is that Moabite girl who we have no responsibility towards. At worst, she is nothing. Nobody recognizes her. But if we pay attention carefully, Ruth's name, as I said, appears four times in this chapter. The first time, she turns to Naomi look at the chart that I brought for you. You'll see it more clearly here. Source number six. She turns to Naomi, in Pasuk Bet, and she says, and it describes her words as follows. Vatomer Ruth HaMoaviyah. Ruth the Moabite speaks. But when the narrative describes Boaz's first speech to Ruth, the narrative describes his perspective, the manner in which he sees her. And what does it say? Vayomer Boaz el Ruth. This is Boaz's perspective. He doesn't see a Moabite, just Ruth, a person, a subject who stands on her own merits. And I want to draw your attention to something else, and it's also part of this chart, and that is that Boaz's attitude has immediate repercussions. Naomi, who has not yet spoken to Ruth as Ruth, picks up on Boaz's approach. In fact, from the beginning of the narrative, Naomi seems to have been somewhat wary of her daughters-in-law. I know that it is accepted to read Naomi as trying to dissuade Ruth from coming with her because of altruistic reasons, but that's probably not the pshat, right? What, in fact, does she say in the pshat? Mar li me'on mikem. I am very embittered, perhaps because of you. This is certainly one accepted midrashic reading. In fact, there's one midrash that tells us that Naomi sent her daughters-in-law back because she did not want to return to Beit Lechem accompanied by a Moabite. And in fact, after attempting to dissuade Ruth from accompanying her on three separate occasions, Naomi doesn't speak to Ruth again for the duration of the chapter. In fact, the words that describe Naomi's response to Ruth's great speech of loyalty is Vatechdal lidaber eleha. She ceased speaking with her. In fact, one of the things that I think we have to point out is that when Naomi speaks to the women of Beit Lechem when she first comes back, she completely ignores Ruth's presence. Did you notice that? She never mentions Ruth. And then, of course, neither do the women. right? To some degree, Root is certainly standing there, right? Root is standing by as the dramatic dialogue unfolds, but no one refers to her and no one pays attention to her. And in fact, what I want to suggest is that it is Boaz that causes people now to regard Root as Root. What are the next two occasions in which Root's name are mentioned in the narrative? Well, the first one is in, look here, the chart, is in verse 21, where Root again turns to Naomi as Root the Moabite, Vatomer Root HaMoavia, and this time, Vatomer Naomi El Root. Naomi speaks to Root. Naomi's ability to begin to regard Root not just as a Moabite, but as a subject who has a name, who has an identity, who is a person in their own right, is triggered by Boaz, who models this behavior. And because I keep suggesting over and over that Naomi's textual representation mirrors that of the nation, she's a microcosm in the nation, I want to suggest that Naomi's metamorphosis in her relationship with Root, and of course this is going to lead to her taking responsibility for Root in the very next chapter, foreshadows that of the nation, who are likewise going to take Boaz's cue and see Root, but not just Root, all foreigners, all others, as someone who is worthy of recognition, as someone who is worthy as being treated, of being treated as a person. Now, I want to draw your attention for a moment to Perek Gimel, because even though next time we're going to talk about Perek Gimel, I think that in order to fully understand this idea of being able to recognize the other, we have to see what transpires in Perek Gimel. And there's not going to be one class that I'm going to give that I'm not going to relate to Perek Gimel, and that's for one very simple reason. We talked about Perek Gimel a lot in our last class, and that is because this is the critical turning point in the book. It's the critical chapter in the book, and in for our purposes, it is the chapter where we see that Boaz really turns Root from object to subject. It's not simply that Boaz restrains himself from making a sexual advance in this story and instead promises her that in the morning he will find her an appropriate marriage, right? Bruchat Lashem Biti, blesses her in the name of God. But rather, once again, it's how Boaz goes about this that is important. The key is the manner in which Boaz sees the other. Boaz refuses to see an object. He sees a person. He sees an identity. And let's look at what happens in Perek Gimel. Root goes to the fields at Naomi's behest. She arrives at the field at night, lies at Boaz's feet. Boaz is satiated and even inebriated, right? Look at what's described in Pasuk Zayin. Vayochal Boaz vayesht, vayitav libo. His heart becomes merry, okay? And in Pasuk Chet, look at what is described. Vayhi b'chatzi halayla, and it was in the midpoint of the night. Vayecherada ish vayilafet, and the man is frightened and he is seized perhaps by a trembling. Vihine isha shochevet margilotav. And we're going to talk about this in our next week's class, but for the moment, I want you to pay attention to the fact that there are no names in this pasuk. It's just an ish and an isha, just a man and a woman reduced to their gender at the threshing floor at night during the summer harvest. And what is going to happen? Now, the text and Chazal as well, the Midrashim as well, have this sense that the narrative is building up our expectations that this is going to be a Tamar and Yehuda-like scenario. They are going to sleep together in this scene. That's going to be the next moment. But look at what Boaz does in Pasuk 10. This is, I think, the greatest moment in Megillat Rut. Vayomer mi'at. Who are you? That's his absolutely unexpected response. This is a turning point in the book, and it's a turning point in the period of the judges. Boaz wants to know Root's identity. He gives her the stage to state her name. That's what she says, right? Vatomer, Anochi Root. I'm Root. Thank you for asking, right? And there's a sense that he does not want to regard her just as a gender, just like in the previous chapter, he didn't want to regard her just as a Moabite, just as a race, but he wanted to see her as a person. Who are you? And in this chapter as well, Boaz paves the path for Naomi. If in the previous chapter he enables Naomi to see beyond the Moabite status of Ruth, look at what happens when Ruth gets back to Naomi at the end of the day in Pasuk Tet Zayin. I'm in Perek Gimel, chapter 3, verse 16. Vatavo el chamota vatomer mi'at biti. Right? The first question that she asks is, who are you? Now, I'm not suggesting that Naomi actually heard Boaz say that in the field, but I'm suggesting that the narrative, by creating this literary parallel, both in chapter 2 and in chapter 3, in which Boaz models a certain regard for Ruth. In chapter 2, he regards her not just as a Moabite, and then Naomi adopts that regard. And in chapter 3, he regards her not just as a gender, not just as a vessel for providing continuity and seed. And then Naomi actually imitates that as well. And this brings me to my final topic for tonight. I want to talk for a couple minutes about names, and then we'll conclude this shiur. Having raised the topic of names, and of course, here part of the idea is that Boaz provides Ruth with an opportunity to state her name, I want to note how important the topic of names is in Megillat Ruth. We noted this a little bit in our last class. The narrative opens with the deaths of a family that leads to the threatened destruction of their name. The goal of the narrative is Lahakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato, to restore the name of the person upon their narrative, upon their inheritance. Now, we have throughout the story the sense that names are threatened, and I'm trying to suggest that this goes right along with what's going on in society. When people don't see each other, then we are threatened with the loss of names, and that's why Naomi says, I don't want my name. Al tikren ali Naomi. This is why Ruth wanders through Beit Lechem, initially in this anonymous fashion. And let's not forget the Goel's purposeful namelessness at the end. He is called Ploni Almoni, the man who has no name. Names are very important for the narrative, and I would say that if there's one theme in Megillat Ruth that can't be missed, it's the attempt to restore the name. Of course, we note that names are intertwined with a person's essence, with his ability to identify himself, with his ability to fulfill his destiny. Without a name, without an identity, no one can fulfill their destiny. And more important, of course, if society is devoid of names, as we have at the end of the period of the judges, society flounders. It has no identity. It cannot fulfill its destiny. And so Boaz, the champion of our story, is the man who restores names throughout the story. This is due in part to the fact that he has a name. He has a name because he has a nachala. Right? We know that the name is connected to the inheritance. And this is a man who has a portion of land. He has a sense of identity. And we are introduced to him as a man with a name, Ushmo Boaz. And as we saw, Boaz provides Ruth with the opportunity to pronounce her own name. And so Boaz's ability to restore the names of the dead upon their inheritance that we have twice in chapter 4 should not surprise us in the least. But I also want you to see, look in chapter 4 in verses 9 and 10, when Boaz actually buys the field and the rights to marry Naomi. Look at what he says. Vayomer Boaz lazkinim v'chol ha'am, edima atem hayom, ki kaniti et kol asher la'elimelech ve'et kol asher la'chilion u'machlon miyad Naomi. He mentions every single name of the family. We have not heard neither about Machlon nor about Chilion since they died, and he actually restores their name in the narrative. Now, the word name, Shem, is one of the key words of chapter four. It appears a crucial 7 times in the chapter. And of course, the goal of the union of Ruth and Boaz, we're told twice, is to provide a son who will have a name. I want to show you these two descriptions. Pasuk Yud Aleph in chapter 4, verse 11, the people bless Boaz, and they say, Yitein Hashem et ha'isha ba'al beitecha kerachel u'chelea asher banu shtehem et beit Yisrael v'asecha be'afrata Ukrashem b'Beit Lachem. He shall call a name in Beit Lechem. Now, all of the different exegetes, they do backward somersaults to try to understand what this means. What does it mean, call a name in Beit Lechem? Does it mean he'll be famous? Does it mean he'll be important? Does it mean he'll be prominent? I think it means exactly what it says. It means that he shall be the one to restore a name. And we have the same exact thing in Pasuk Yudalid. When the women bless Naomi, they say to her, Baruch Hashem asher lo ishpit lach goel ayom, blessed is God who has not withheld from you a redeemer today, v'karei shmo b'Yisrael. He shall get a name back. He shall restore the name for Israel. And the book ends with names, right? The 10 generations from Peretz to Chetzron to Ram to Aminadav. And of course, the final name is that of David. All of this is coming to correct the prevailing anonymity that we have at the end of the book of Judges, in which society is depicted as having lost their names, no longer able to recognize the other, no longer able to recognize themselves, no longer able to fulfill neither their personal nor their national destinies. We have a similar situation also in Yitziat Mitzrayim, the book of Shemot. Ironically, the book of Names is about the loss of names, right? How slavery turns the people into a faceless, nameless mass of humanity that has lost its sense of self, that has lost its sense of destiny, that has lost its ability to achieve anything. Only by acquiring a name can a person achieve their personal destiny. And only by recognizing the other and giving the other a name can society become a people, a group that has a national destiny, a healthy and creative society which can realize its ultimate national destiny. This, of course, is one of the goals of the Davidic dynasty. David, who is our final name in the book and our final word in the book, David makes it possible for people to have a name, for society to have a name. When the king has a name, and of course David is described as Vayikar Shmo Me'od, his name was very precious. David has a name, and he has an identity and an awareness of his destiny. Then he is able to confer upon society the ability also to have names, and all of this begins with David. And so the establishment of the name in the book of Ruth has repercussions that reach far beyond the narrow scope of the story of Ruth. Boaz's ability to give food to a stranger, a foreigner, evolves from his willingness and desire to recognize the other, to restore the name for the other. This paves the path toward an idyllic national and religious state of affairs in which people have names and society has a name and a destiny. This looms hopefully ahead in the establishment of the Davidic dynasty. We began our shiur tonight by speaking about Naomi's dual existential predicament, food and continuity. In our next class, we will focus our attention on procuring continuity for this family. And tonight we have spoken about the attempt to obtain food, but primarily we have seen that the underlying cause of the problem and its solution lies in the alienation which prevails between people during the period of the judges. And we've seen how Boaz corrects this situation simply by recognizing the other and offering them their name. Thank you.